You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
This is MLB.com Extras, American League Central Edition. I'm Anthony Kastrovitz. Thanks for tuning in once again. It's week two of the 2015 season. And boy, the Tigers and Royals got off to a scorching start, kind of establishing themselves once again as the leaders of this deep division. Tough start for the White Sox and Indians, tougher than expected, and the Twins have already taken some major rotation hits. So we're going to check in with all the beat writers from those five clubs and see what's going on with each of them. Well, thank you all for joining us. Let's bring in Jason Beck to talk about a Tigers team that got off to a roaring start to the 2015 season, and much of that due to an offense that just exploded. Beck, it's kind of, I mean, this is kind of what they expect from this offense. It's obviously a deep lineup. You know, 2-6 is as good as any 2-6 in baseball, but they've gotten some contributions from other guys as well.
Yeah, you know, you look at the hitting leaders, and I know it's a small sample size, but as far as the AL batting leaders, Jose Iglesias has been up there. Alex Avila has gone off to a pretty decent start. He looks like he's got his eye back at the plate. It's looking like a more balanced offense than I think a lot of us expected. And I'm not sure, I wouldn't expect that to continue long term, but right now I think it's a benefit for them, especially as they kind of wait for, expecting Cabrera and Victor Martinez to get even healthier here as they get further and further along, separated, they're going to get more and more at-bats. As scary as that sounds for a guy like Cabrera.
Miggy's start was just scorching. And what he did in Cleveland first weekend, 11 for 14 with two home runs. You know, we talked all spring and all winter about, you know, what do you expect from Miggy coming off the ankle surgery. That was the injury was worse than even the Tigers expected when they went in there and surgically repaired it. And he didn't have his lower body, couldn't work out his lower body all winter, but so he was definitely a question mark going into spring camp. And then towards the end of the camp, he really turned it on from a power perspective, and that's really carried into this season.
Yeah, it really has. I think we saw that on Sunday in Cleveland, where you can't expect to be able to get away with mistakes with him again. Not that you really could before, but I think some people might have thought that as he got his strength back, he might be able to at least get away with singles instead of home runs. And then the weekend series in Cleveland came, and he was hitting mistakes, he was hitting decent pitches from some guys, and just made it look like a team that has seen him for years had never seen him before. As weird as that sounds. And I think I wrote the other day that it's the best three-game stretch from the Tigers hitter since Walt Droppo had the 12 straight hits in 52, which is crazy to think about, going that far back.
Well, Mickey's had some great series against the Indians. It seems his whole Tigers career has been torching those guys. And got to the point on the Sunday of that series where Terry Francona finally just intentionally walked him in the eighth inning. With Victor Martinez coming to bat, which is, that's a dicey proposition in and of itself, but I think it speaks to how quickly Cabrera asserted himself this season.
Yeah, and that's huge for these guys. Jamie Kinsler talked about it the other day that, when he gets rolling like that, all Kinsler is looking to do is just kind of set the table for him and string things along. On some level, you're just trying to get as many guys on base for him as possible. But the way Kinsler has started out, too, he's gotten his share of RBI opportunities, and he's kind of compounding the problems where, like you said, from 2-6, this is a scary stretch to face. And at some point, and we saw this with TJ House on Sunday, you've got to make a pitch to one of these guys, and you have to be precise with it. It's going to be tough for a lot of pitchers in this league to be able to do it. I think there's more pitchers capable of doing it in this division than there were a year ago, but it's still going to be a challenge for a lot of these teams as you run through the course of a 162-game season and you start dealing with teams' third, fourth, and fifth starters. And that's really where I think a lot of people are looking at it and thinking, you know, that's where this division could be decided. I think we're at the point now where, at least at the top level, you know, these ones and twos kind of even themselves out to some degree. Or do you expect them to?
You know, we expect great things from this offense, and everybody is, questions the bullpen given the Tigers' history. Obviously, off to a rough start there from an injury standpoint with Joe Nathan out and with Bruce Rondon out. What's the update on both of those guys and their timetable getting back in the mix?
Well, we're kind of waiting and seeing on both those guys. Nathan isn't supposed to even pick up a ball again until, I guess, at least the end of the week, if not later. He's going to have to be pain-free before he does that again. And they're going to give it some time. I know they're saying that they're expecting it to be a minimal stay on the DL, but it's the type of injury where I think we've seen it plenty of times over the years where this type of thing lingers. And it takes a while to kind of get everything out and get a guy back into his normal delivery and his normal throwing program. When you add the age factor that Nathan has into the situation, then I think this is kind of an unknown for him. I think there's a huge kind of range for what you would expect for the type of absence here. This could linger a while. I wouldn't be surprised at all. Rondon, I think he's going to be lingering a little longer than a lot of people expected as well. They shut him down from throwing for a little bit over the weekend to give him some medication and kind of get him some therapy there on the biceps tendonitis. And I think we're waiting to see if he's resumed throwing here this week. If he does, I think you can see the path back to activity pretty quickly for him, given the age. But it's a little trickier there. And then once he does get back, is he going to be somebody you can slot back into the bullpen right away? Or are they going to want to give him a little bit of seasoning at AAA on a rehab assignment to get him back used to facing hitters again, since it's been so long since he's done that in a regular season game situation? We're going on almost a season and a half now since he's done.
Yeah, he's I thought he was a big key to their bullpen this year. Especially if Nathan did falter in the ninth. Not that Rondon immediately jumps in the ninth inning or anything, but obviously Joaquin Soria is capable there, but Rondon still be from a setup situation or whatever. He's just a big live arm that they need back there.
Exactly. Yeah, he's their answer to Kelvin Herrera.
Yeah.
The type of guy who you can put into most any situation, whether it be a strike, looking for a strikeout or just looking for, outs plural, and feel like, if you can save him for high leverage situations, you like your chances, no matter who's up there.
While we're talking about guys with biceps issues, what's the latest on Justin Verlander?
He's got a simulated game coming up on Wednesday. If he gets through that okay, I think that should be the last step to get him back into the rotation. Then it just becomes a question of when do you slot him in? Do you try to sneak him into the weekend series against the White Sox, or do you try to, give him a little bit more time, play it safe, then return him against a Yankees lineup that seems to be struggling offensively? Not really getting a clear sign on that one. They've got flexibility there because they wouldn't need a sixth starter until I think the next Tuesday of that Yankee series, so they can play around with it there. And in the worst case scenario, they can start Kyle Obstein another time through. I think we're still kind of waiting to see how they line up the rotation for that White Sox series. But you know, they have options here. They're not necessarily facing the type of deadline they had last week with him as far as, you know, you need to put him on DL, you have to call up a starter or reliever. You know, that stuff's out of the way. So you've got the personnel to be able to handle whatever happens from here. And it's just a question of his health, how cautious you want to play it, and how much he pushes to try to get back in as soon as he can.
And certainly seems like the question with the Tigers is just going to get the pitching staff to do enough to keep the opposition at bay and let that offense take care of things from there. They certainly a lot of firepower that can offset you know, some of these injury issues going on in the pitching staff. But they'd obviously like to see it all come together at some point. But I want to thank Jason Beck for joining us and talking about all matters Tigers, as usual. Joined, as always, by Jeffrey Flanagan. And, Jeffrey, the Royals got off to a red-hot start, won their first six games. By the time people listen to this, maybe they have won another or finally lost one. But either way, very promising start for a club that came oh so close to that World Series title last year. And, you know, you got the sense with the Royals in spring training and now that the season has started that they're still on this mission to prove people wrong. I know a lot of people were counting them out. We've talked about before the Pacoda projections, mm-hmm. and Fangraphs projections and things like that, but now that you've seen it in season, I mean, these guys are playing like their hair's on fire, basically.
Yeah, it's to a man, the players told me this was going to happen. I mean, maybe not go 6-0, but they said all spring they were going to be a hungry group that had a lot of unfinished business, still angry about losing Game 7 last year, and they weren't going to be complacent, and they've come out, and I think this is kind of who they are, although this is times two or times four because they're just hitting on every cylinder right now. The bullpen has been phenomenal. Starting pitching has been great. And they're hitting the crap out of the ball. So it's just and of course, they also play flawless defense. They've made one error, and that was kind of a tainted one when Giordano didn't cover the bag. But, you know, they just do everything they do well. They run bases, and they're a handful to play against. And I remember Adam Eaton talking about after the White Sox series for the White Sox center field, just saying, hey, you know, those guys play the game the right way. They play the game a fun way, and they're hard to beat because they can beat you in so many ways. And we saw that last October. We saw it for much of September, and we're seeing it again now.
Absolutely. Eric Hosmer had probably the line that sums it up. He said, we're hungry and we're on a mission, especially with the way, as you said, the way Game 7 ended. I guess the question you ask is, can they keep up this intensity all season? They're playing with the kind of intensity they showed in that eight-game winning streak in October last year. You know, it's a long season, and you wonder if they can keep that chip on their shoulder, I guess, all year.
Yeah, I don't think they view it that way. I don't think they feel like they're doing anything super extra right now in terms of energy or emotion. They're just playing the game that they believe they can play. And it probably looks to other teams like, you know, they're in playoff mode already, but they're just out there. Look, it's a very loose group. They're having fun in the clubhouse before games, after games. You know, they're still doing the James Shields post-game celebrations that he started a couple years ago. So it's like a big disco party in there after games. And they're just a very loose group. And it's a clubhouse that really gets along with each other. And the new guys that fit in terrifically. So they're... This is not. I don't think they view this as an exception. You know, you're going to lose games. They all know they're going to have a spell where they're not going to win. But you know, Detroit's 6-0 too, and I don't think anybody's too shocked about that. And I don't think they should be too shocked either if the Royals are 6-0. But you know, baseball turns on a dime, as you know, and they've got to take care of the Twins this series.
Absolutely. You know, this early start, obviously, when a team starts out 6-0, a lot of people are doing things right. But who strikes you as maybe, it doesn't have to be a surprise, but maybe the most encouraging aspect of this? Is there one guy whose performance has been probably the most encouraging for them?
Well, I'll go with a couple guys. Number one, you know, we were all kind of anxious to see, I can go with three guys. Morales, Kendrys Morales, who's, you know, coming off a horrible year last year, and he had a good spring and a solid spring, and he's got his timing down. And he's just been a huge addition in the number five spot, being a switch hitter, too. And he's come out, and he's hitting everything that's thrown to him. you know, Alex Rios too has been pretty dialed in from the beginning of camp till now, and he's coming off, you know, another down year. And of course, Sal Perez, we're seeing what he can do now when he, you know, had a couple built-in days off and he didn't, you know, get overworked in spring or anything. So, like, we're seeing a very healthy, rested, energetic Sal Perez, and he's got three homers already. And really, the biggest surprise probably so far isn't that they've got six wins. It's that they've got nine homers already. They've been this is a team that was last in the big leagues in home runs last year, and already they've got nine this year. Maybe coincidentally, too, they've also been hit nine times by pitches. So, but I'd say that, you know, the biggest surprise probably is just, you know, the power, because they've got so many ways to beat you athletically, defensively. They're great bullpen. They run base as well. They put the ball in play. But now they've got this other element here where they're hitting home runs, and well, they're really hard to contend with when they do that.
You mentioned a well-rested Perez, and that's something that we're going to be watching all year, how Ned Yost handles his workload. He caught all six games here early on, every inning. And yep. I know Yost has said it's tough. It's tough to take him out of the lineup. Eric Kratz, of course, the backup. But when Perez is going the way he is, it's really hard to take that bat out of the lineup. But I guess at some point, is it just the manager just has to flat out make that move and you know, submit the lineup with Kratz in it and basically especially to establish that, I guess, early in the season, that this season is going to be different than last year from a workload standpoint.
Yeah, it's you know, you got to feel for Ned in that situation, because what do you do? I mean, you got a Gold Glover, an All-Star, who started off the season on fire. I mean, he's got three home runs already. I think he's hitting around 400 or something, and playing great defense. And Sal, as you know, wants to play every single day. You know, when the season ended last year, after he set a major league record with starting 158 games, goes to Japan and plays some more. I mean, he's just kind of a nut that way. He just wants to play all the time. And they do have to find a way to get him some rest. Now, I will say that Ned's not as concerned about it early in the season. When he wants to start giving him rest will be in July and August, so he's ready for the stretch run in September. So I don't know how much Kratz is going to play. He might play Thursday, a day game after a night game. I wouldn't bet on it, but, I mean, I think that's the best opportunity. Ned kind of hedged on it this morning when I talked to him again. And, you know, he's and they're winning, too. I mean, you don't really want to disrupt anything right now. They might get off to a record start here. I think the Royals' record's 9-0 for starting the season in 2003. And maybe Ned wants that record, you know. And his best chance is always going to be with his Gold Glove All-Star catcher in the lineup. And until Sal starts showing a little bit of fatigue, and I don't think you're going to see that early in the season like this, I don't see Kratz getting a lot of time. He might get a spot start, but we'll pay a lot more attention to it come June, July, and August in the middle of the season when Sal last year played almost every game there too and then was just completely worn out by the time he got to September and October. So give him some middle of the season rest, get him ready for the stretch run in September and October, and hopefully he'll be fine.
Well, one of Perez's great strengths, of course, is working with his pitching staff, and he's a big part of their sustained success the last couple of years. And mm-hmm. Edinson Volquez joins that group this year, and his debut was terrific. Jeffrey,
yeah.
It wasn't a total mystery what you're going to get from this guy, but of course, last season was such a stark difference from his 2013 season in San Diego. So yeah, I was curious at least to see if he got the season started off on the right foot, and he sure did.
Yeah, and you know, he had kind of a shaky spring, and we talked to him a lot about that in the spring, and he told me he's never ever had a good spring. You know, he's just not an Arizona guy, he's not a Florida guy. But once the lights went up and the curtains went up, and the lights went on, he really showed up and pitched a heck of a game against the White Sox, and the type of game you would expect from him. You know, he's not going to strike out a ton of guys, but he keeps the ball down in the zone. He keeps pounding the ball down and just let his nine great defensive players do the job for him. And that's kind of what happened against the White Sox. They just a lot of guys made great plays, and that's how this staff thinks. You know, they don't have to take the hitter themselves. They don't have to strike everybody out. Just keep the ball in play. and good things will happen, and they have been. You know, they've been getting sensational defense out of Escobar and Moose and Hosmer, and the outfield, of course, Kane's been like Kane always is. He's just been terrific. And so you just don't have to strike out 15 guys or 10 guys. Just, you know, just don't walk anybody and put the ball in play. And like I said, good things happen. And so far they have been for Volquez in his first start. And I think they expect that pretty much regularly all year.
Another guy who had a strong performance in his first appearance for the Royals was Chris Young, coming off of that comeback player of the year season in Seattle. And I just, for your talks with him in spring training, how has he adjusted to this bullpen role, and how's he taken to that mentally? Because that is a big adjustment, especially this late stage in his career.
Yeah, he's kind of admitted it's a work in progress. He's not sure how many, because he hasn't done it before, he isn't sure how many days off he needs in between. And Ned was really trying to get him into a game here. He hadn't pitched since the end of exhibition against Houston. And so, you know, you get kind of rusty, and they still got a couple other guys in that category, too. Franklin Morales hasn't thrown yet. And, you know, Madsen's thrown a little bit, but, you know, they had to try to get Christie in the game. And yesterday is a perfect opportunity. They're up 9-2. You know, Frazier works them out of the sixth and seventh. And now you just need someone to just calm everything down and just get you through the game. You can save your HDH trio for today. And they got that out of Chris Young, and that's going to be his role. And if they got big enough leads, you know, you might see him go three innings at a time. And, boy, will that help late in the season. You'll have a fully rested HDH later in the year if you can get that kind of performance out of Chris Young. And he's fine with it. He's embracing the role. He's happy to be on this team. And he's just got to learn to see what his body can do, how fast he can come back off a two- or three-inning stint.
Well, I don't know who wouldn't be happy to be on the Royals at this stage. They've been a lot of fun to watch. It's been like October all over again, and Jeffrey Flanagan does an awesome job covering it all for Royals.com, so be sure to check out his work. Joined by Jordan Bastian, who was just telling me the tale of the time he lost his scorebook this past weekend. That's really, if you know anything about Jordan Bastian on Twitter, you know he's very dedicated to his annual scorebook, whereas most sane individuals like myself would prefer to just get all their information online here in the year 2015. Jordan, how are you holding up without your scorebook?
Oh, man, I'm doing all right. You know, I've been, I got scorebook junior now, you know, the original one, rest in peace. We had a tragic three-person spilling incident in the press box during Sunday's game against the Tigers. Two writers to my right spilled drinks, and as we all scrambled to save our laptops, you know, it created this chain reaction. My coffee was the last to go, and it just drenched my scorebook. You know, but much like Michael Brantley's back spasms, you know, if it's going to happen, you know, you'd rather get it out of the way in the first week of the season, you know, and then go get your new scorebook so, you know, you don't waste a whole season's worth of games.
Well, it was a rough weekend for everybody in and around the Indians, not just you and your scorebook, but you mentioned Brantley's playing through some back line and not always playing through the back situation that's held him out quite a bit in this first week. And then the bigger deal is the Yan Gomes injury on a really tough loss on Saturday. Again, the Indians kept fighting back to get in, but losing Gomes was a bigger deal than losing that game. He's out 6 to 8 weeks with the knee injury. And Jordan, you know, people ask me about this. I say it's like if the Cardinals lost Yadi Molina for 6 to 8 weeks. It's that big of a deal, offensively and defensively. Roberto Perez is no slouch behind the plate by any means, but you're not going to bat him fifth in your lineup.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's precisely what Francona said. Is, you know, I think defensively, I think fans might be surprised that there might not be that much of a loss in terms of game calling, controlling the running game, pitch framing, all those things are areas that Roberto Perez scores high in. And one thing that they've really enjoyed about him is he's, you know, done an admirable job at preparing himself for when he is in the lineup, being at least a threat offensively. I think we saw on Sunday he drove a ball to deep center that maybe on another day would have been a home run, but, you know, these early April windy conditions kind of knock some of those down. But he's a guy who has that ability to drive a ball out. You know, maybe we're going to see him be overexposed being in there every day, or maybe we're going to see him fit in nicely. I think it's what they've said, though, talking to Sandy Alomar, talking to Corey Kluber and some of the pitchers talking to Francona is that, you know, this guy could be a starter on many other teams. He's a backup in Cleveland because they have Yan Gomes. So definitely a tough loss. You're right. I mean, he's Cleveland's Yadi Molina, just without the name recognition yet. I think he is getting there. So, I mean, that's a big loss. Silver Slugger bat. You know, before the game on Sunday, he was out there on the field on crutches collecting his Silver Slugger award, which is kind of a apt summation of a pretty horrible weekend for the Indians.
Yeah, and the Brantley thing, you pair it with the Brantley thing, and you kind of double down on that frustration. And Brantley is obviously, and he played in the home opener, and almost immediately they said he probably shouldn't have played in the home opener. It's something that's been bothering him since the beginning of spring training, so we're going back a couple months at this point.
Right.
It doesn't sound like that's something that's just going to, he's going to wake up one day and feel magically better.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see. I mean, he played for the bulk of the spring training games and played through it and performed well. So, you know, it did apparently go away for a little bit, but this is something you got to be careful, especially when he's your number three hitter, your all-star, your MVP finalist. This is a guy that you want to make sure this thing calms down and, you know, doesn't become something that lingers throughout the season. So, you know, they probably have discussed a DL stint, and right now they've held him out of some games. So, you know, if they do decide to go down that route, you can retroactive the date. So, I mean, that helps, but it doesn't help right now that he's out of the lineup for sure.
No, and just in general, you know, losing three early is no big deal. Losing three to the Tigers always feels like a bigger deal because they're the Tigers and they're the four-time defending division champs. And it's a team that the Indians just have nothing but trouble against. Miguel Cabrera always seems to make Progressive Field his own. Did that again over the weekend. Do you sense at all that the Tigers kind of in these guys' heads at all? You know, I know that's kind of a cliche and maybe even more of a football thing, but it's certainly a team they've had more than their fair share of difficulty with over the last couple of years.
Yeah, I think more than that, it was just shutdown innings. You know, the Indians, if you look back at those games, a lot of times they were scoring and they were pulling within distance or tying the game up. And then the next inning, you know, whether it was a starter or whether it was the bullpen, you know, it seemed like they were coughing up runs immediately thereafter. And that kind of can get more in a lineup's head than I think the opposing team that man, we just fought hard and pulled back in it and the pitchers just let it go again. And that was what we saw throughout that series against the Tigers. And, you know, it's three games in April out of 162 out of 19 meetings with the Tigers. You know, I think you don't want to overblow it, but at the same time, you know, that it's a very division-heavy schedule out of the gates for this team. And as we all know, the old cliche, you can't win a division in April, but you can certainly lose it. And that played a big role in the season last year for the Indians. They had a slow start in April. They finished, I think, a few games back of a playoff spot, you know, after, you know, tightening things up and performing better down the stretch. So that was one thing they wanted to do differently this year, was get off to that better start, especially with such a division-heavy slate. And so, yeah, it's discouraging to see that against the Tigers. Now the White Sox are coming to town, and it's not going to get any easier. You've got, you know, some more division games coming up against the Twins, Royals, back to the Tigers. You know, so it's going to be interesting to see, you know, how this team fares. I think maybe this off day on Monday came at a good time, allowed them to collect themselves, kind of settle in back in Cleveland after opening on the road and kind of have an awkward schedule. So, you know, maybe that came at a good time.
Yeah, to your point about the shutdown innings after the team battles back, we saw that in the Saturday game against Detroit, and then the battling back came off the bat of Jerry Sands.
Jerry Sands
a legend here. Yeah, it reminds me of the old Jerry Springer episodes, and we talked during spring training. Anytime a manager, you know, voluntarily brings up a guy's name in an interview session, your ears perk up because you're like, okay, that's a guy who's definitely going to be on the roster at some point, and it's way earlier probably than anybody expected, but here he is, and he made that instant impact.
Yeah, you know, and kudos to the Cleveland fan base for just immediately embracing this guy, and then kudos to the scoreboard operator for jumping right on it and putting Jerry flashing up on the scoreboard when they first started chanting his name. And, you know, I mean, that kind of turned into its own animal throughout the game. Disappointing that it came within a loss, but that was really fun. And, you know, I mean, honestly, this is a guy that reminds me of a younger version of Ryan Rayburn. He's kind of a journeyman, been with a few different organizations, but he's a guy that can, when he's going well, match lefties, provide that right-handed bat off the bench that can kind of counteract the many left-handers that the Indians routinely have in their lineup. So, you know, it's an interesting guy, a guy who obviously made an impact or an impression in spring training, first guy to be called up when they ran into an issue during the season, and now he's a cult hero in Cleveland. I think we're going to see some T-shirts popping up in some of those trucks around the ballpark pretty soon.
Maybe they had the scoreboard graphic ready from the old Jerry Brown days, the governor from his his time with the Tribe. It could be a leftover. And then, you know, Jerry Sands kind of comes almost out of nowhere, had the wrist injury last year and bounces back in a very positive fashion from that this spring. But a guy who really waited a long time to get back to the big leagues was Sean Markham. Had been almost 2 years since he made an appearance, and he comes on in relief on the Sunday game. And another guy this spring, you kind of got the sense that he was going to have his say here before long at the big league level, again, earlier than expected. With his promotion, but certainly a nice bounce-back story there, JB.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and I think one reason he re-signed, I think we've talked about this before, one reason he re-signed with Cleveland to that minor league deal, and another reason that he, you know, waived his out clause and went to the minor leagues to start off was he felt he kind of owed it to this organization because of how much they've allowed him to come back, you know, through setbacks and just stuck by him. And obviously he rewarded them with five strong innings in that game. You know, and again, he gave the Indians a chance to kind of claw back into that game. It just didn't happen. But you're right. I mean, that was a good story of a guy who, you know, at his height was a pretty reliable arm consistently for the Blue Jays, you know, when the American League East lineups were even tougher than they are now. And Tito Francona obviously remembers him from managing the Red Sox. I think that's one of the reasons they wanted to bring him in, just because of that memory of him going up against Boston. You know, and this is a guy who's got that veteran presence. He's not going to blow anyone away. I think he was hitting around 85 with his fastball, but you saw he was effective with it, you know, in changing speeds and things like that. And he's a real athletic guy fielding his position, controlling the running game. So it'll be interesting to see what they do with him. I mean, they've got some roster decisions to make. They need to bring up a backup catcher, and, you know, they're going to have to clear a spot on the 40-man roster. And, you know, there's some difficult choices to be made there, and I'm not sure where or if Markham will figure into that or somebody else, but definitely an interesting situation, and, you know, happy for the guy for all he went through to kind of come back and initially have that performance.
Well, so far it's kind of reminiscent of 2 years ago with the Tribe in April, having to make a slew of transactions early on, which is not ideal. That season they obviously rebounded and made it to the playoffs. We'll see what happens this year, but certainly some early adversity for the Tribe with the Brantley situation and definitely with the Gomes situation. So we'll continue to monitor all of that and check in with Jordan Bastian frequently. Pleased to be joined, as always, by Mr. Scott Merkin, who's been covering the White Sox for, what, Merk, 30, 35 years, something like that?
I think it goes back to Billy Pierce and Louis Aparicio and those days back then.
Yeah, that was back when WhiteSox.com was a GeoCities page, I believe. Very encouraging.
It wasn't internet until Al Gore invented it, right?
That's right. Very encouraging return to action for Chris Sale, coming off that foot injury in spring training. Really took it to the Twins, which, yeah, it's the Twins. They're off to a pretty horrendous start offensively, but that still was impressive stuff, wasn't it, Merk?
Yeah, the Twins not a great baseball team, very young too. But you know, the funny thing is, there's a little stat to throw at you: the only AL Central team Chris Sale has a winning record against is the Minnesota Twins, which you would think.
Is that right?
It can't be the case. He's 500 against, I believe he's 500 against Detroit, 100 against Kansas City, 100 against Cleveland. And he owns the Twins. He's 7-1 against the Twins. But, yeah, excuse me, just a great effort against, you know, just what you'd expect from Chris, except a little higher velocity this time around.
I guess Robin Ventura was throwing out a Sandy Koufax comparison after the game. That's a pretty strong comparison right there.
Yeah, Chris is a really good-natured kid, has a good time with life, you know, a family guy, enjoys just, you know, I think the whole baseball experience. But if he never hears another comparison to Sandy Koufax or Randy Johnson or any other great Clayton Kershaw, he'll be fine by that. You know, he's, as he said to me yesterday, he's a baseball player. That's it, you know. Doesn't want to really analyze how the team's made up, doesn't want to analyze the bullpen, just wants to talk about his start and how the team played on that day. And But, I mean, you know, he's got that extra gear that Sandy Koufax had when he was a pitcher.
Well, it's only natural. We do that with
yeah,
lefties.
That's our job.
You know, we like to throw it out. It's probably unfair to everybody involved, Koufax included, but Chris Settle's obviously a good one. I'm pretty shocked by that central note. I'm going to steal that, Merck.
It was pretty exciting to me. I looked it up when they were about to face the Twins, and I just happened to look at the other one. I know Cleveland has really got him. Cleveland really got him the year that Cleveland basically went to the playoffs courtesy of the White Sox when they were 17-2. That was 13. And they hit it. They're the only ones who really hit him hard that year. But, yeah, you know, Detroit and their four division titles in a row have got him a few times, too, and Kansas City the last couple of years. So it is strange, though. It really is for one of the best pitchers in baseball. The teams he faced the most, he's only .500 against one of them. Of course, that goes without saying that, you know, he hasn't been on great teams the last couple of years and probably has lost some 2-1, 1-0 games in there along the way, too. We all know about the prevailing opinion about the one-loss record to judge things by.
And perfect transition there, because Jeff Samardzija showed that last year with the great start he got off to with
right.
the Cubs and couldn't buy a win the first couple of months of the season. We talked a bit about Samardzija last week, Merck, his rough opening day start. His second start was kind of, it was an interesting moment there after he'd given up four runs in the second inning. White Sox looked like they're on their way to yet another loss. They're 0-4 at that point. And then something clicked for the Shark and for the Sox. But you think that was kind of a galvanizing moment for this club?
Yeah, I mean, you know, again, I don't want to go too simplistic and say, you know, like I could hear it like being narrated on a film about, you know, with some music playing in the background at all.
Next year's DVD,
Yeah, when Samardzija walked off the mound and screamed into his glove after, you know, getting hit hard. I mean, these were... In that second inning when he gave up the four runs, these were not like little dink shots. These were line drives all over the field.
Right.
And he did. And, you know, he pounded his glove. He screamed into it. He told us afterwards in the last that he couldn't tell us what he said because he'd be fined if he did. But he said he had to talk to himself. He was the only one to blame. He talked to himself and settled down. But, yeah, you could see the team. Maybe that was – forget about it, like a turnaround moment. Maybe that was just a moment about, hey, you know, we're a good team. Enough of this already. You know, we got beat by the Royals, a very good team, a 6-0 team, no way around that. We played one of the worst games we'll probably play this year against the Twins in the home opener, and now we're down 4-0 in the second. Let's move it, you know. And to Samardzija's credit, as Sale pointed out yesterday, he got them through seven. He got them through 113 pitches. Didn't really burn the bullpen. Had a couple off days this week, so that was really a huge kind of turnaround effort. After he had six good innings and one forgettable inning in that start.
You've been known to have those turnaround moments, Merck, in the press box, like you have writer's block and then you spill your drink, right? And then everything turns around.
The favorite of all my colleagues is when the wireless doesn't work. That's when I'm at my peak form. That's like I've been watching the Sinatra show on TV, and that's when I'm like the Sinatra of meltdowns at that point, then, when the wireless doesn't work. And especially if it's like right before you got to send something or right near the end of the game, then it's prime form. But I've tried to stay a little, you know, as I'm getting a little bit older in my early 30s here, I've tried to mellow a little bit.
You got to settle down at some point, Merck. Speaking of settling down, well, these transitions, I'm just all over the place with them.
Isn't that a Desperado lyric, I think?
What's that?
I think you got to settle down. Is something from that from Desperado.
Oh, you got to come down from your fences, yeah. You just derailed my great transition. But I was going to say
sorry.
The bullpen that settled down this year was Zach Duke and David Robertson. Very encouraging start from those guys, as we expected. I mean, we knew the bullpen was a rough situation for the White Sox last year, especially with some injuries in the mix. So those guys have settled down the back end in a hurry, haven't they?
Yeah, I think the bullpen last year, there were some bad performances. I think there were also some performances out of alignment, as you know how that works, Anthony. Guys who were closing shouldn't have been closing. You know, Lindstrom got hurt. Nate Jones never threw a healthy pitch the entire season. So now you're scrambling to kind of fit inexperienced and even some veteran pieces into where they weren't supposed to be. So I think this year, much better alignment with, Zach Duke, you know, as a primary setup man, David Robertson, who has just been great the last two games against the Twins, you know, closing, and you have a mix of Dan Jennings and Javi Guerra and Zach Putnam, and then when Dick Patricio gets healthy in front of him, you have Nate Jones and Jesse Crane, who should help during the year. Matt Lindstrom signed with them. So there's many, many options now. And the best thing for Robin, and Cooper said, it's not Cooper said this a number of times, is for 4 years now, they know who is going to be pitching the ninth inning when they're leading.
Right. Jose Abreu at third base. Is that a thing? Is that really going to happen in interleague play?
You know, I was doing another radio show, and that it was pretty much that same question, I think. And the thing was, you know, I was told when he had his showcase before the Sox signed him, when everyone was hot and heavy after him, and they were watching him play, one of the things he did was he worked out. He took grounders to third base there. And I thought, oh, that's kind of interesting. So he took some the other day on Friday. He was at shortstop yesterday during BP, but just kind of stood there. I don't think he took many ground balls there. But he took some on Friday, and we saw him do that. So I went and talked to him with the help of Billy Russo on Saturday. And Jose's a great kid to deal with, really, you know, upbeat. I guess there's really not much reason for him to be downcast right now with the, you know, the career he's off, the start he's off to. And he said that he started as a shortstop, if you can believe that, and then played third, wow. He played the outfield, he played second, and just kept outgrowing the positions. He wants to play first, but I think third for Jose is more emergency or interleague-type play. If Robin really believes that, hey, we need to get LaRoche and Abreu into the lineup at a National League park, then you never know. You know, hey, Paul Konerko played third base a few games for the White Sox, and I would say Abreu's range is probably a little better than – Paul Konerko was great at everything around first base. He, had, by his own admission, didn't have the greatest range. So, you know, Robin said he liked what he's seen in terms of the infield, you know, that Abreu was taking at third base. So you never know. Never say never. I was actually a little surprised by Robin's answer. I thought he'd kind of laugh and say, maybe an emergency, we can throw him out there. But, you know, he made it seem like it could be an interleague option at some point down the line.
Oh, that's interesting. I guess Abreu on a very limited basis at third base is better than Yasmani Tomas on a full-time basis at third with the the D-backs are trying to, you know, squeeze a square peg into a round hole kind of thing there.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to see the number five on the lineup card regularly next to Jose Abreu. I think it's going to be three or DH for the most part this year.
That sounds like a plan. That sounds good. All right, and you sound good, Merck. As always, want to
thank you
for joining us. And joined by Rhett Bollinger. Rhett, a rough start for the Twins, to say the least, to the 2015 season. It's not just the results on the field, but just the feel with that rotation. We talked last week at length about the Irvin Santana suspension. Since that time, Ricky Nolasco's elbow injury, fortunately not a structural situation, no surgery involved here, but will rest for Nolasco, who, of course, is a big bounce back. They need a big bounce back season from him in that rotation. So what's your read on that injury and the severity of it and how things look for them going forward in that spot?
Well, the good news for the Twins, at least it's not anything structural. It's just the inflammation there in the elbow. I think the hope still is that he could come back once those 15 days are up. They don't know for sure yet. He's still kind of, you know, resting it and all that. We'll see kind of how it goes later in this week, I'm sure. But the good news was, maybe if he's back in a few weeks, it won't be such a big deal. But it is tough, like you said, the start of the season to lose Irvin Santana. They signed for $55 million to lose him for half a year. And then, like, you know, last year they signed last year for, you know, $49 million. That's over $100 million just in those two guys alone. And they're both about these guys for at least the first couple weeks of the season for Nolasco. But it gives Trevor May an opportunity now to kind of take that his starter slot and see how he does with it.
Trevor May was the unexpected starter for the home opener. We're actually recording this just before the home opener, but just speaking about May in general, Rhett, it's not like he was totally undeserving of a rotation spot in spring training. It's not like he got, you know, totally roughed up every time he went out there. What were the thoughts on him in camp as far as his readiness for this kind of a role? It's obviously come sooner than expected as far as the need in the rotation, but thoughts on him from the spring and moving forward?
Well, he had a good spring. And last year, obviously, his rookie year, he had some ups and downs. Started off, you know, pretty struggled a lot there early with all the walks and everything. But kind of calmed down the last couple starts of the season to show that, you know, why it's such a big prospect. And I think the spring kind of came in with that mentality of attacking hitters and not walking guys, and I think it showed. I think he had a good spring and definitely was in that mix for that fifth starter spot. And obviously ultimately didn't get it, and neither did Mike Telfrey, and sure enough, now they're both in the rotation. So it's a big start for May here in the home opener, see how he does. I think going forward, too, just obviously the Twins think highly of him. He throws hard. He's a good pitcher in the minors so far, but I think it's just a matter of kind of getting that transition up here to the majors and working on that command. I think it's still kind of his biggest issue. If he can command that fastball and you know, get ahead of guys, I think he's going to be a good pitcher up here. It's just a matter of him kind of doing that.
Right, I wasn't aware until recently of his side career as a DJ, or he was a DJ in a previous life, I guess. DJ Hey Beef.
Yeah, now he's actually DJ Mazer. He changed it. But yeah, he's definitely had his all his tracks, and he sweeps them all out. And I think even his music when he comes out to the field, I think is going to be one of his DJ Nazer tracks. So that's definitely his big hobby off the field.
Okay. Well, they need him to whip up the post game victory mix. Would be nice for Mr. May and for the Twins as well. How about the offense, Rhett? A big part of going 1-5 on that opening road trip was getting outscored 33-13. I had a miserable time trying to score runs in Detroit. Things improved a little bit in Chicago, but that was the one area of this club that we kind of banked on being a strength was the offense, really.
Yeah, so far, definitely the offense has not been living up to its hype, I guess you could say. It's also easy to keep in mind it's only been 7 games. Obviously, they can break out from here, and they did face some really good pitchers in that stretch, open the year. Obviously, in Detroit with Price and Anibal Sanchez and Jeff Samardzija and Chris Sale. So, I mean, it's awesome good pitching. And Joe Mauer has been the only guy that's kind of been above average. I mean, Mauer's having a really good start to the year, which is definitely a good sign for the offense going forward. But a lot of other guys, including Torrey Hunter, their big addition this offseason, has struggled offensively. So I think it's just kind of a matter of kind of getting these guys kind of gelled together in the lineup. I don't think the offense is going to be, the issue going forward. I think this season, I think the offense is probably going to end up being fine. I still think more than anything, it's just that rotation and the fact that, like we talked about, having Nolasco and Santana out definitely does not help their case with that.
Hey, you mentioned Mauer. I guess you'd call it a slow spring offensively, and then the lights come on and he turns it right on. Just goes to show not to read too much into those Grapefruit League results.
Yeah, definitely. He's been really, their best hitter so far. No extra bases yet, which is kind of the one little thing, but hitting, 300 with a good on-base percentage, drawing those walks. I think the other thing that's kind of a positive thing is I think he's only struck out, I believe, like 4 times in 24 at-bats.
That's exactly right.
One looking the other day, he definitely didn't like it. He definitely argued a little bit with the home plate umpire. But that's kind of been the worry recently in recent years. The strikeout rate keeps going up, which obviously hurts his batting average. And a lot of his value is tied into the fact that he hits for high averages and draws a lot of walks and kind of goes deep into counts. So definitely a really good sign for this offense. If they can get Joe Mauer to, produce like he did a couple of years ago before the concussion, and then have some of these younger guys we've seen, Dozier, Plouffe, Santana, Vargas, these kind of guys, to have kind of seasons like they even did just last year, I think this offense can be pretty good. It's just a matter of it all kind of coming together here.
Yeah, limiting the strikeouts will be a big factor going forward for all the Twins. 49 strikeouts against 15 walks in those first 6 games, so certainly something that has to turn around. Rhett, on a more positive note from the pitching standpoint, Tommy Malone had a really solid debut for 2015, 7 2/3 innings, only 2 hits allowed. We've talked about him before as kind of an X factor in that rotation, but what's been the change, I guess, for Malone this year versus his struggles when he arrived with Minnesota last year?
I think the biggest change is that he's healthy. I mean, last year when he came over from Oakland, he had neck stiffness. Didn't really know why. Turned out in the offseason, he was diagnosed with a benign tumor in the back of his neck. It was removed in December. I think it was kind of limiting his range of motion and just kind of uncomfortable out there on the mound. He wasn't really healthy. Because his track record suggests that he's a pretty good pitcher. I think his career RA is in the 3s. Obviously not a big power pitcher, but he's a lefty with good control. I think it was kind of a surprise for him to struggle as much as he did coming over to the Twins last year because I thought so highly of him. So I think that first start was kind of the first time Twins fans have maybe really seen the Tommy Malone the Twins thought they were going to get. Obviously, he has to prove it. It's only one start. But to do as well as he did and prove that he's healthy and show that command that he showed when he was with the A's is definitely a good sign for the Twins.
And that was, of course, Paul Molitor's first victory. Tommy Malone did his part to lead the skipper to that. How's Molitor handling this early adversity in his first season at the helm?
Well, it is tough. It's his first week here, and obviously to win just the one game was, a tough start for him. But I think he's one of those guys who's very even keel, doesn't get too high or too low. So I think that's kind of good for the players. They don't see him panic ever, so I don't think they panic in the clubhouse or really worry about anything because he's kind of that guiding force for them. And it's nice to have a guy like Torrey Hunter who's been around as long as he has kind of be the vocal guy in the clubhouse. Mulder can – because Mulder's not as vocal as maybe like Gardy would have been. Right. But you have Torrey in there to kind of be the clubhouse kind of leader that can talk to these guys, let them know, hey, I've been on teams before that have struggled really bad early in the season, ended up turning around and having really good years. So I think that's kind of the whole thing. Even Mulder said that, and he uses this term a lot with some of the advanced stats, but, small sample size. And I think more than anything, a 1-5 start gets magnified because it's the start of the year. But even good teams go through 1-5 stretches during the season. So I think that's right. Kind of the message they keep saying is just it's just magnified at the start of the season. But obviously, when you're coming off of 4 years of 90-plus losses, the fan base is easily going to say, wow, another year like this, it's already starting this bad. Is it going to get any better? And who knows, maybe it won't. But, I mean, I think there's some optimism, at least from the players in the front office and from Mulder, that it is going to get better this season. But, like I said, it just kind of all remains to be seen.
Well, it all starts with that starting pitching. The ERA, staff ERA, is over 6 to start the year. Certainly hoping to whittle that down in the coming days and weeks. And we'll continue to check in with Rhett Bollinger on this podcast. And I want to thank you all for tuning in. This has been MLB.com Extras.